Top 5, a show where we count them down from 5 to number 1. I mean, this is Top 5 after all.
It's not Top 7.
Email this week. I'm pretty sure we've done this topic. But someone wrote in and says, hey, speaking of movies, how about you guys... Didn't know we were speaking of movies, but how about you guys do your Top 5 action movies?
I don't think we've done this topic.
Really? I'm pretty sure it was like one of our first topics. But just to make sure I'm not repeating Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark in my Top 5, which would have been number 1 and number 2, I went exclusively with action movies from the 21st century.
Ooh. See, I don't remember ever having done this, and the reason why I think that we haven't done it before...
Carl will correct us, of course.
Well, he will. He'll tell us chapter and verse. But I said to Sarah, and I said to Stacy, what are my favorite action movies? And they both looked at me blankly like, you don't watch action movies. You're a nerd.
Okay.
So I don't think we've ever done this one.
All right. Well, then how about we start with Rodrigo with his number 5?
Okay. My number 5 is in my number 5 in my list because it has one of the best sort of protracted action sequences that I've ever seen. And this is going to be kind of a theme here for a bit because there's a lot of action movies that do very long action scenes and I get bored. I just can't focus on it. I start like spacing out and thinking about groceries or like what video games I'm going to play when I get home or whatever, right? Lord of the Rings, the Two Towers, specifically the Battle of Helm's Deep, is such a well-blocked and well-paced action sequence containing multiple action scenes within it and sort of like bouncing back and forth in a really good way. It made it into my list.
Awesome. Very cool. My number 5 is one that I never thought I would have on my top 5 list, especially based on the title alone. And then I watched this movie and I was like, you know what? This is actually a very solid action movie with Tom Cruise in it.
Is it Surf Nazis Must Die?
I said 21st century, and no, that would be on the top 5 worst movies of all time list.
Okay.
My number 5 is Edge of Tomorrow, also known as Live, Die, Repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a crazy action movie because it involves like time travel in a sense, in that Tom Cruise's character, There's this alien invasion and it's been going on for a long time. Tom Cruise finds himself on the front line. He dies. And then the moment he dies, he wakes up and he's like, oh, I'm right back where I started. And then it repeats again. But each time he starts to die, and he remembers everything that happened before, so he even remembers his move. So he knows that the last time he got killed, he should have ducked at this time, and so he becomes one of these greatest weapons, the greatest fighters ever against this alien invasion. He also finds out that there's another woman who saved his life the first time, who also had this kind of power for a while, and comes to find out that he accidentally stole her power from, he stole the power from her. And it becomes this very wild chase to find essentially the brain bug of this event. And it's nonstop fighting, but it's a very cool alien time travel movie. And I never thought I would like it. Of course, The Edge of Tomorrow is probably a better title than Live, Die, Repeat. Although they're both kind of solid names. That's my number 5.
A big reason why that movie didn't make it as well as they hoped, I think, is because of that title, because nobody knew what Edge of Tomorrow meant.
Right.
By the way, it's based on a manga, I believe, which is called All You Need Is Kill.
Yeah, that's right. That is absolutely right. So there, it's got another plus to be on my list. It's also based on a comic book. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew, what do you have for number 5?
Well, as we mentioned, I'm a nerd. So when it comes to action movies, you kind of have to look at it and say, what is action? And for me, I started
thinking about my dinner with Andre is not an action movie.
Well, right. But I started thinking about my favorite movie. It's actually a very, very strong movie about the familial bond and two brothers who fall into an existential quandary and how they have to save their childhood home and make this extended pilgrimage across the state of Illinois while avoiding Illinois Nazis and destroying literally every single police car in existence. And I said to myself, this movie literally holds records for most cars wrecked, or at least it did at one point. So 1980s The Blues Brothers is definitely an action movie. It's quotable.
I'm pretty sure it's listed as an action comedy. So, I mean, it totally fits in there.
Yeah.
I'll make the case for it. You know,
action comedy musical.
Exactly. And, you know, all of the music is diegetic, which I know you love. And there's that sequence where they're just walking around and all of a sudden there's John Lee Hooker on a piano. And then we have the sequence and then we move on. And it's got that just that wonderful kind of an understated tone. And then something will happen that is so over the top. But because everything was so understated beforehand, because Aykroyd plays it so close to the vest, and even Belushi in his own little way is restrained in this movie. So when they have the moment where the Vega containing Henry Gibson and the other Illinois Nazi crashes off the overpass and you see it falling past the tip of the Chrysler building, just falling and falling and falling. It's so wonderful. And then, of course, you know, it crashes to the ground, causes this enormous, ridiculous hole that Elwood immediately jumps the Bluesmobile over. And that extended sequence in the mall. Oh, the new Oldsmobiles are in early this year.
Yeah.
Disco pants and haircuts. Yeah, this place has everything.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that is the probably actionist, actiony movie I've ever loved. And you can't hate that. And I think the best part about that movie is actually sitting and watching and seeing all of the directors cameoing in this thing. Because Spielberg's in it and Frank Oz is in it and like two or three other guys, you're just like, why do I know this person? I know I've seen their face, but I don't know what I've seen them in. And you look it up and it's like, oh, that's the guy who directed Groundhog Day. And that's why my number five crashes many, many cars and has 106 miles to Chicago and a pack of cigarettes in the dark. The Blues Brothers.
All right. Excellent. Rodrigo, what do you have for number five?
I already did my number five.
Oh, I'm sorry. Number four. I can't count. I even had it highlighted here. Number four.
No. It's top four.
We're just going to talk about our number fives today.
Your other number five is?
My other number five is, so I brought up that Helm's Deep is a really long action sequence. And so my number four kind of takes that to a whole other strata by being pretty much one, the entire movie being one long car chase, which I guess could also apply to the Blues Brothers, but I'm talking about Mad Max Fury Road. Movie from start to end is basically one single action sequence. There is very few moments in which we jump in time. There are very few moments in which we pause to do anything. You know, there's like two conversations that aren't done while shooting outside of like shooting out of a car into like a bunch of other cars. And amazingly, I went in, I did not expect to like it, but I really did. I think it's really well put together. And a big part of it, I think, is the editing. This movie is just masterfully edited. If you look at something like any given Transformers movie after the first, because I think during the first Transformers movie, the studio still had a leash on the director. But after that, Michael Bay they were just like, yep, here's a bunch of money. Do whatever you want. And they're just like this mass of like twisting metal parts and explosions that most of the time don't actually make sense. You can't tell what's going on. But in Mad Max, you always at Fury Road, you always know what's going on. You can see the consequences, like cause and effect of actions, even as all of these absolutely nutso things are happening on the screen. And there's a lot happening at once, but it's just good editing. It keeps you on what needs to be happening rather than necessarily being like, oh, look at this cool thing. Look at this cool thing. Look at this cool thing. So Mad Max Fury Road accomplishing something that I thought was impossible, which is holding my attention for that such a long action sequence.
Mad Max Fury Road is actually my number three. And the reason why it's in that number three position for me is I think it's a really solid film. I really enjoy the story up to a point until they kind of turn around and say, oh, well, we made it this far. I guess we'll go back. And yeah. that's the, that little hiccup in the story kind of spoils it or ruins it for me. But there is so much action going on. There's so much practical effects in this movie. You know, granted, they're not fighting in a literal sandstorm, but like those guys that are on the big pole arms going back and forth between the cars, that's a practical effect. Guy with a giant flame thrower shooting out of his guitar, that's a practical effect. So much
well,
of those.
Not
so
exactly mu- practical, but.
Well. Meaning it is a
not,
real
not
effect.
Not a CG effect.
Yes, yeah. not a CG effect.
But
so much of that, so much of that movie is just great from top to bottom because they're just like, you know what? We're just going to roll film and you guys drive this way and we will actually have the guitar player beating out the music and drummers in the back drumming out the sounds in real time so that everyone knows what their coordination is for this stunt. So Mad Max Fury Road, my number three, really, really good. My number four, though, is a movie that first I was like, oh, the specter of the original is going to ruin this film for me. And then when I saw it, I was like, oh, this is kind of like another movie, even though they were both shooting at the same time and both finished at the same time. But this introduced me to the magical world of the versatility of Carl Urban. Mm-hmm. I mean, he plays Dr. McCoy in the Star Trek movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I sat and
he's
watched.
He's actually in the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. He's the head of the writers of Rohan.
Wow. I sat through all of Thor Ragnarok this past weekend, and it wasn't until I was watching the credits I was like, fudge, that's Carl Urban. This guy can do anything, including put on a helmet and not take it off for an entire movie and say, I am the law. I'm talking about Dread. If you haven't seen this crazy movie, you should watch it because though Mad Max Fury Road cranks it up a notch and why it's on my number three, Dread, which is telling the Judge Dread story, is basically let's assault this building floor by floor and see as Dread takes out his enemies one by one. Some crazy special effects in this thing. Some very cool use of slow motion with this drug that people are using. If you haven't seen Dread, go check it out. It's my number four, and it's totally fantastic.
You want to know something cool?
What's that?
As someone who used to work and play syndicated programming all weekend long, I will tell you something about Carl Urban that you probably didn't realize, is that he was a recurring character on Xena Warrior Princess.
Yeah, I didn't really watch that show that much.
Oh, I had to. You had to watch it for the, well, you didn't have to watch it, but the commercial breaks were on.
Oh, no, I'm just, you know, so surprising because when you see him in like in Star Trek and then you see him in like Thor Ragnarok, don't look anything like the same person. And when you see him in Dread, when you look at McCoy's chin, you don't see that in the Dread helmet.
Oh,
and
sure.
It's just like, wow, what
it's
there's
his,
some.
It's that underbite. He just sells it.
I guess it is. I mean, he is just. He totally is absorbed into his role, so much so that you're not sitting there going, oh, hey, that's Matt Damon playing this role. It is, wow, this guy, whoever he is really good. Steven, it's Carl Urban. He's one of your favorite actors of all time. Really? That's not Carl Urban. No, seriously.
He's been in a lot of good movies and a lot of bad movies.
Oh, sure.
Like
Star Trek Into Darkness. Yeah, that was a horrible movie.
He was in Priest, and he was in The Chronicles of Riddick.
Mm-hmm. He was also in Pete's Dragon, so there you go.
Yep, him and Zoe Saldana just chew the... was it Zoe Saldana in the Chronicles of Riddick? No, I don't remember. But anyway, he plays one of the bad guys in Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So there you go, my number three and four. Matthew, let us hit your number four, please.
My number four, I didn't encounter until probably the summer of 1988. And by that time, it had been out for several years. I was at a party at my friend's house, and I can't remember which friend it was, but I know he had a ridiculous name. It was like Goose or Dorcas or Jim Bob or something. And I was sitting bored because there weren't enough girls, and I was ignoring what was going on the TV until I started looking. I'm like, what are they doing? And it turns out they were shooting this guy, just shooting him, not just shooting him to death. He was killed to death. And then, you know, just blowing up and bursting like a bag of blood. And I'm like, well, this is interesting. And then they stick him in a helmet, kind of like Judge Dredd, only, you know, silver. And then they like turn him into this robot and then they make him a cop. And I'm like, what is this? And finally,
it's called The Wizard
of Oz. Yeah, it was The Wizard of Oz. I was paying attention to this and the Yellow Brick Road came up. And I'm like, I don't know what any of this is, but I kind of love it. And some guy was like, I'll buy that for a dollar. And that was when my love affair began with Paul Verhoeven,
I think it's.
Paul, what's his name's?
Yeah.
RoboCop.
From Verhoeven.
Yeah, almost got an X rating in its initial release.
And I can see why, because, I mean, that the violence is over the top. There's a part where one of the punks, played by Dr. Romano from ER, explodes. I mean, literally, Nancy Allen drives a police car into him, and he just explodes all over the place. At one point, you get to see Kurtwood Smith, Red Foreman, get impaled in the neck. Just death, 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 and sports. It's just amazing. And the thing about it is a movie that you look and you take it seriously and you are drawn into this world, even though every aspect of this world, from their entertainment to their socio-political status to the violence of their world, is over the top and ridiculous. It's another movie kind of like The Blues Brothers that goes too far repeatedly, and by going too far repeatedly, it kind of comes back around the other side to where you buy into this impossible dystopian crap sack future. And it may not even be the future. I don't even know what year this takes place. It's somewhere in Detroit, I believe, in the year
if I remember correctly, but it's supposed to be like 2010 or something like that.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's already one passed. Of those
future crapsack worlds that's in our past.
Yeah. But
it's just a beautiful movie, and it has so many moments where you're just like, yeah, everything explodes. And then you have that quiet moment where, you know, Murphy is sitting there and he's like, I need the drill. And he pulls this 14-inch screw out of his head, and you're like, how is that not impaling his brain? Oh, right. And just such an amazing film in terms of the action, but also a film that you really feel for him. And when he takes off the helmet and you realize there's almost no humanity there, and they've stretched his dead face over a robot skull, it's awful and it's just dehumanizing and it's terrifying. And then you get to the end of the movie and somebody says, what's your name, soldier? And he's like, Murphy. And you're like, yeah, there's like 2 pounds of organic material left of this man, but he is still Alexander Murphy. And that is why my number four, RoboCop, big giant action explosion movie with bags of blood everywhere.
All right. So as far as the year that this is set, initially the co-writer didn't set a date. He says, when people asked him when it was going to be set, he said, I'm not going to tell you. That way we can kind of let it be up to people's imagination. However, in the book, the book adaptation of the movie,
which ruins everything,
it says that Sylvester Stallone died yesterday during an unsuccessful brain transplant. Longtime supporter of bioengineering, Stallone was 97. His last film, Rambo 38, Old Blood, will be released posthumously next month. So if they go by his 1946 birth date, then that would put this movie in the year 2043 and maybe even the first half of 2044.
So still in our future.
Yes.
Which is beautiful. I'm good with that because I feel old enough. You realize that Lost in Space takes place in the year 1994, right?
Yeah. And don't forget, what was it? What's the one where the moon blew up and Space 1999? That one's also passed.
Oh, my God. You realize that the dystopian crapsack future from Days of Future Past in X-Men is the far-flung year 2013.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
We are so friggin' old.
And the book 1984 written in 1948.
No part of Back to the Future is now in the future.
Oh man. And hey, we're still using sucky 1997 Skype technology.
Yep.
Rodrigo, please dazzle us with your number three, please.
All right. Am I working? Is my mic on?
You are working now, and Skype has settled down, and your internet service provider appears to not be throwing a tantrum anymore.
We can hear you. So, this will be appropriate. My number three is The Matrix. And The Matrix is sort of guilty of a lot of, or, you know, it's like because of The Matrix, like The Matrix kind of was a paradigm shift in action movies. And it was because of The Matrix, I think, we have a lot of these kind of tired, like high kung fu, like guys in suits jumping at things kind of movies now. Mm-hmm. Which I think we're just barely starting to move away from. But The Matrix is on my list partially because of nostalgia, is, you know, something that came out when I was in high school and I was super into it. It made fighting in a suit look cool. So, you know, it also made Halloween costumes a lot easier. So you could just throw a pair of sunglasses on the suit and be just like, I'm an agent. Something that The Matrix did was it had very motivated special effects to go with its action sequence, which is good. Did you guys ever see Romeo Must Die?
I want to say yes. Is that with Jet Li?
So that is Jet Li. Yeah. It's basically a Romeo and Juliet story set with like a Chinese gang and a black gang.
Yeah.
That movie had like X-ray fracture vision. Like he would like punch somebody in the face and you would go to like this X-ray thing and you would see their bones crack and stuff. Which is cool. It's a cool idea, but it's not motivated by anything, right? It's like this guy wasn't an X-ray tech, mm-hmm. or didn't have penetra vision. it's just something cool that they were showing. But everything about The Matrix, all of the like freeze 360 effects, everything that was happening, even if you don't see it at the beginning, as you see the movie is motivated, right? There's a reason for all these like crazy special effects to be happening while the fight is happening. And after The Matrix, we kept seeing stuff like this that wasn't motivated, right? They were doing these 360 freeze frame things because The Matrix did them and because they look cool,
right.
But not for any sort of motivated reason. So, that's kind of an important part of my list, is that these movies are sort of doing, kind of innovative, interesting things with action. And there's an in-story reason for them, right? Not just because things look cool, or at the very least, they try to find an in-story reason to make these cool effects make sense. So my number three, The Matrix.
Neat. I already mentioned my number three, Mad Max Fury Road, so we will jump right over to Matthew and his number three.
My number three is, excuse me, sorry about that. I had something in my throat. My number three is one of the things for which I will never, ever forgive Zachary Wolfe. Those of you who've listened to Top Five for a long time know that we do a lot of these things, and we'll do a thing, and somehow I'll tell the same story five times in five different episodes. Hi, Carl. And sometimes we'll have a moment where we really argue about something, and I'm not going to say the C word because it's not that, but we did one about either B movies or bad movies or terrible movies, and Zach was like, yeah, this is a terrible movie, or so I've read. And in his defense, he's a young man, you know, he was going by what he was told, and people tell you a lot of things, and people tell you things that are entirely wrong and false, and one of the things that they told him that was false was that 1979's The Warriors is a bad movie. That is a lie.
No, you're right. It's not a bad movie. It's just not a very good movie.
Okay. You are not a part of this discussion. Go over there.
I'm just saying it's not a bad movie. It's got some solid parts, but it's not a good movie.
It is an excellent movie. Well, I have this thing in my head where some things are movies and some things are films and some things are flicks. This is an excellent flick. And this is a pretty okay movie. I don't know how it rates as a film because, I mean, I kind of gave
it was
that
shot on film.
That's true. But it's basically the story of a street gang that goes to a midnight emergency summit of all the street gangs in New York City and gets framed for murder. And they are accused of killing a very high-powered gang leader. Basically, every other gang in the entire city wants them dead.
Yeah, have
so
you...
The Warriors,
this is, if you weren't aware, this movie is actually a remake of The Odyssey of Homer trying to get home.
The Anabasis, yeah.
Yeah.
And it is fascinating, and it's very 1970s, and it's very, very New York movie 1970s. You know, it's full of moments that I think probably don't really play well 40 years later, or God, it's been 40 years. Oy. Excuse me, I'm just going to be over here depressed in the corner. But the thing about this movie that just makes it so wonderful is realizing there's a moment about halfway through where our main characters, who are played by the guy from Xanadu and the pretty girl who looks like the other pretty girl, they're sitting on the New York City subway and they see a couple of teenagers getting on their way to prom. And they sit and they look at each other and you realize that the Warriors are also kids. And that all of these people that are trying to murder each other are basically big, dumb kids. And also there's mimes with baseball bats. So how can you hate that? But it's got some really strong action sequences. It's got some wonderful emotion at the base of it. It's got the guy who plays T-Bird later in The Crow, mm-hmm. whose name always escapes me, David Patrick Kelly as Luther. And David Patrick Kelly is an American treasure, my friends. There are two things you know him from. It's this and The Crow, and both times he's playing a goofy gang leader in a weird crapsack world, but it's two completely different portrayals, 15 years apart, and you realize that this man should have been in literally every movie ever.
Yeah, you know what? Every time I see him in The Warriors, and I've watched this movie a couple of times, mm-hmm. every time I see him, I keep thinking that he is the killer from Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, yeah, because
he looks just like the guy that's
Brad DeReef.
Yeah, he puts the lotion in the basket. That guy.
He does look a little like that guy. It's also got Lynn Thigpen, who you may remember as the chief mm-hmm. from Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. Actually, just her jaw and lips.
Yeah,
because she is the DJ who plays music all night long and secretly sends out messages to the gangs throughout the city. And that's part of the framing device of the movie is we keep seeing this unseen DJ narrating what's going on. And mm-hmm. in so doing, telling the other gangs how to find and kill the Warriors.
Yeah.
And you get to the end and, you know, half the gang is dead. The other half has nearly been beaten to death, but they've made it home to Coney Island only to get absolutely blindsided by hundreds and hundreds of gang members. And you're just like, is it over? And I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but I will tell you this. It ends with a Joe Walsh song. And if you can find any movie that ends with a Joe Walsh song, you need to go watch that movie. And that's why you're going to go watch The Warriors. I know you're thinking it right now. It's probably streaming somewhere.
Probably is. It's
Matthew,
probably easy to get.
Have you ever played the Warriors video game?
I so want to, because it's from the Rockstar North guys, right? It's from
yep.
the people that did Grand Theft Auto.
Yep.
I've always been like, oh, I should pick that up when I see it in a used store, but I never have. And
you
I really
should. It's been
to.
Pretty well received both by people that play video games and don't know anything about the Warriors and about people who like the Warriors.
See, I like the Warriors and I love Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, it really seems like you would be. I've never played it, but it really right. seems like something you'd be into. And it's a PlayStation 2 game.
Oh, so I could play it.
Yeah, so I think it's compatible because you have a PlayStation 3, right?
I have a 3 and I also have a 2 in which.
Yeah, oh, well, there you go.
So, yeah, I may have to dig that up. Sarah, write that down. For Christmas, I need the Warriors video game.
Okay.
Stop giving me the finger.
Rodrigo, why don't we get to your number 2, please?
Number 2. So my number 2 is on the list because it takes action and it does something really well, really good with it, which is comedy. And because of that, it also edges out a lot of good action comedies. But this is probably one that I've watched the most, you know, unless you count like The Lion King as an action movie or something, which you could. There's plenty of action in that. But my number two is Shaolin Soccer. And it is a just absolutely ludicrous movie that takes basically like superhero level ability characters and puts them in this like just crushingly mundane world. And they're kind of trying to use the fact that they are like insanely deadly kung fu warriors just to make ends meet, like in a non-violent way, I guess. So the first half of the movie is just this guy trying to apply the only thing that he knows how to do, which is kung fu, to everyday activities, and it just goes terribly. And then the second half of the movie is they find that they can apply it to sports, and it kind of works out for them, except for the fact that none of them actually know how to play soccer. It's really weird. It's really funny, and the sense of humor is kind of always tongue-in-cheek for it. A lot of people really love Kung Fu Hustle, which is another movie by the same team, basically. But out of the two, I really prefer Shaolin Soccer, again, because a lot of the time, the stuff that happens in it is a lot more motivated, in my opinion. Like, Kung Fu Hustle has a lot of crazy things that happen in it, but very often I watch it and I think this is happening because it's funny, or this is happening because it's cool, rather than it really having that sort of like weird in-world motivation that a lot of the stuff in Shaolin Soccer does. But that's just my opinion. A lot of people prefer Kung Fu Hustle to it.
All right. I'm going to have two movies in my number two, because ideally they're supposed to be watched in one sitting, but the studio was like, no one's going to sit through a 4.5 hour movie. How about we release these like 6 months apart, and we'll call it Kill Bill Volume 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2.
Oh, so that's one movie, dude.
It is really one movie.
It really is.
And so that's why I feel okay with it being at my number two position. Take everything that you love about Quentin Tarantino and everything that you love about Asian cinema and everything that you love about just really great cinematography and choreographed fight sequences. Mix it all up with some revenge and a little bit of weirdness, and you have Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2. It is solid action. I think, again, what makes it work is that it is totally an homage to everything that has come before it. And Tarantino has admitted that he loves ripping off other directors, other stories, other things to tell the story that he wants to tell.
Other scores.
Yeah. So if you watch and understand what's going on in Kill Bill, you have seen, you know, 50 years, 60 years worth of Asian cinema right there on the screen. So, Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, my number two. Matthew, what do you have for number two?
My number two is the one that's going to make many of the people listening, and probably at least one person on the panel, go, and there it is, because I had to mention it.
Is it Surf Nazis possible. Must Die?
Yes, it's Surf Nazis. Okay, no, so there you go. Surf Nazis Must Die. No, but it is another thing that you will go, and there it is, because it is so endemic to the things that I enjoy, and it is flat out action from top to bottom. Basically 95 minutes of explosions and giant robots and things from space, and a moment where 199 superheroes line up together against an endless wall of villainous mooks, followed by 10 solid minutes of just, hey, it's that guy.
Oh, so Surf Nazis Must Die too.
And I'm talking about Gokaiger, Go Sager, Super Sentai 199 Hero Great Battle, which was the 35th anniversary Super Sentai. They call it a versus movie. It's the summer team up between the current team and the previous team. So each year, the Super Sentai series has a new team of guys and they have a whole new gimmick that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the previous gimmicks. But in this particular movie, in this universe, they all happened in the same world. And it is literally just overwhelming to watch. It's amazing. And there are stories about where are we going to get, you know, how did we hire enough people to do all of these massive action sequences? They literally hired nearly every suit actor and stunt person on the island of Japan in order to do these sequences. And I recommend this to anyone and everyone just randomly in the street. I'll walk up and say, hey, take a look at this. Isn't this awesome? Go watch it now. Because it simply is that good. You don't have to know anything about Super Sentai, because I didn't necessarily when I came in. I had a basic rudimentary knowledge. But because of this movie, 7 years later, you can literally show me two Red Rangers who look exactly like. I can tell you the difference between Red Falcon and Red Hawk, simply because this movie is that amazing. It's filled with these massive set pieces. At one point, all 35 of the giant robots, the Megazords, as we call them in America, show up together to fight against a giant villain who's even more giant because they're giant robots, so you need a more giant villain. And
so the giant robots form yet another giant robot?
A giant robot? No.
Because that would be cool.
I will tell you the one thing that really sells it for me. The first Super Sentai series was in 1975. The Red Ranger from that series was 60 years old when this movie was made. He came back out of retirement to play his character, Aka Ranger, and he did some stunts at 60 years old in a Super Sentai movie because why not? Because I'm a 60-year-old man, this is my thing, this is a huge action film, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to, by God, kick somebody right in the face. And that right there, I think, is the price of admission, is knowing that a 60-year-old man was willing to come out of retirement and kick a couple of people to make this feel more really the characters that you, no, not you, maybe you, if you're listening, hi, how's it going? If it's you, I appreciate you and you're awesome. But the characters that some people grew up watching, just an amazing achievement, full of action and big explosions and also people kicking things.
All right. Let's see. We are, I believe, now up to our number one. And Rodrigo, you have the honor of kicking off our number ones.
All right. Well, if we're going to do the there it is moment, then here am I.
Does your answer contain the letter 13?
No.
Does it contain the word surf Nazis must die?
It does not. And it's also not an American Werewolf in London.
Oh, well, there you go.
It is. But it is Princess Mononoke.
Cool.
Which has shown up both in my top fives and just anytime anybody mentions anything on the Major Spoilers podcast, I'm like, hey, there, maybe Princess Mononoke. Because it's the only movie I've ever watched.
And Andalou are the things that you talk about.
Yeah, pretty much. And that'll give you a perfect cross-section of my creative process. I wrote a children's book.
Sorry. Subtle plugs are such fun.
So Princess Mononoke is a very cool action movie, and I think for a long time it was kind of the redheaded stepchild of the Studio Ghibli stuff because it's very different, right?
Yeah.
Spirited Away, Howl's Moving Castle, they have kind of this like whimsy and fairy tale nature. Similarly with Ponyo, although Ponyo kind of skews a lot younger. These kind of like big high fantasy things, but Princess Mononoke is a like rough, violent, bloody, like sad action movie. The main character is thrown out of his village for saving it, and then from there it just kind of gets more and more complicated for him. And this movie has everything. Giant wolves, creepy monkeys, little guys that hang out in trees. And it's like, it's very difficult to kind of explain Princess Mononoke to someone without seeing it. But it is both an incredibly good fantasy movie and a really kick butt action movie. Interestingly, and I think this is just a matter of mathematics, now you can find a lot more Princess Mononoke gear, like in your like Hot Topics and boxed lunches and things like that. And I think that is just straight mathematics. Like Hot Topic has just figured out the formula, right, of when to release things. They're like, okay, so the people that watch, or so it's like 2017, which means the year of people coming in that have money was 1997, let's say. So everything around there, like, let's move all of the, like, or let's say 99. So let's get all the Little Mermaid stuff off the shelf, and let's get all the, like, Aladdin stuff on the shelf, because that's that year, right? Mm-hmm. And you just, like, see this, like, marketing stuff. So all of a sudden, there's this flood of, like, Princess Mononoke stuff. And I'm like, why all of a sudden people are into Princess Mononoke? I've never seen any merchandise for it. And it's like, oh, because that's the year. And it's like, 2 years from now, it's all going to disappear, and it's going to be all Howl's Moving Castle stuff.
Princess Mononoke sticks around, though.
It does, yeah. You know, the Wicked has been going and seeing that for some reason the local films are, they're showing the Studio Ghibli movies. Mm-hmm. And she just went and watched Spirited Away, and then they had Kiki's Delivery Service. And I think they're planning on doing Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, Princess Mononoke is like, that is a formative movie for me. That is something that when I, for example, when I run Exalted Games, I tell everyone, like, go see, if you haven't seen Princess Mononoke in a while, watch this, because that's what this, like, kung fu spirit monster nonsense is. This is what it's going to be like. Just in general, like, if you, again, if you want to, like, take a look in a place to start. And then, you know, An American Werewolf in London, Banshee Inisherin, and Brave Star.
Very cool.
Brave Star is good.
Yeah. All right. My number one, it's probably one that people instantly recognize. It's the family of four. And they all have these individual superpowers. Like, one can turn invisible. Another one can stretch really, really long.
National Lampoon's Vacation?
Exactly. National Lampoon's Vacation. The one where Chevy Chase turns into Mr. Fantastic, and they rocket into space, and the daughter, what's-her-face, who's been played by 14 different girls in all 14 of the movies, turns into a rock monster. Or, I'm sorry, that's Rock Lobster. Oh, it's a B-52s. No, I'm talking about The Incredibles. The Incredibles is a fantastic action movie. And for the 21st century, it is the best of the action movies. Because while it seems like it's borrowing heavily from the Fantastic Four and every other superhero movie that comes before it, it's a movie that has heart.
Yeah.
And it has a message. And when you can combine heart and message and family dynamics and put it into a Pixar joint, you got a winner, ladies and gentlemen. And there is no part of this movie that is dull, that is boring, that causes you to drift off and say, what groceries am I going to buy? Or what's on the Twitter tonight? The Incredibles is just fantastic. And I cannot wait until The Incredibles 2 comes out. What is it, next year?
Either next year or the next, 2018 or 2019.
Yeah, I cannot wait for The Incredibles 2 to arrive. I will be the first person in our theater. Yes, I will. Mark my words.
Because there's only going to be 9 people in your theater.
No, actually, it'll probably be pretty packed. It'll probably be pretty packed. I was surprised. I went to a late showing of the Thor Ragnarok this week, and I was like, okay. And it wasn't late. It was like a 9 o'clock show. And I thought for sure that the theater was going to be packed. And I walked in, it was like half filled. And I sat in my normal third row from the screen. And then about 5 minutes before the movie started, the theater just literally filled up. To the point where people were sitting in front of me, and a super tall guy was about to sit in the seat in front of me. And then he looked at me And I think he knew that if I sit here, I'm going to block this guy's view and he's going to throw popcorn at the back of my head for the entire movie. So he was kind enough and left a little empty seat between him and his friend, I guess.
That's very considerate, tall guy.
Yeah, yeah.
That is.
So here's to you, well Mr. Tall Theater Patron.
Mr. Tall Theater Patron. Heaven
my number one
for you today.
My number one is Pixar's The Incredibles. If you haven't seen it, what's wrong with you? Go out and see it today. Literally, go outside, open up your laptop, and see it today.
I agree. And it's a really good example of how people on the internet don't know the difference between your influences and ripping off another film. It is heavily influenced by the Fantastic Four, but it is a better Fantastic Four story than we've ever seen on film or in a cartoon.
And maybe even in the comic books.
No. There are good Fantastic Four, especially in the first 104 issues.
Sure. But better than The Incredibles?
I would say definitely up to that level.
Do any of them have Cliff Clavin in them? I rest my case, ladies and gentlemen. Matthew, let's go over to your number one. Is it Surf Nazis Must Die?
It is not Surf Nazis Must Die. It was almost the Kentucky Fried Movie. And there's two reasons why it's not, and one reason why it almost was. And the one reason why it almost was is the Kentucky Fried Movie, if you're not familiar with it, is made by the Zucker Brothers, directed by John Landis, and it is a broad parody of other movie trends of the 1970s. And yes, my friends, this is yet another top five list where all of my stuff is below the year 2000. And, you know, I'm old. I'm not going to apologize for it. But it ends with a parody of a kung fu movie that I had not seen until I was well into my 20s and probably should have. You know, if you're me and you're a nerd, you probably should be watching movies like 1973's Enter the Dragon before you're 22 years
probably.
Old. But having seen the Kentucky Fried Movie's parody of Enter the Dragon and then sitting down to watch the actual Enter the Dragon featuring Bruce Lee, featuring Black Belt Jones, featuring some bland white dude, it is just amazing to, first of all, look and see what they did with relatively little. I mean, this is a movie that was made for like $850,000. And even in 1973 money, $850,000 was not like a big budget film. But it's also fascinating just to sit and watch this and go, wow, the structure of this movie is so strong and the action sequences are so well constructed and well put together. And even though the pacing is 40 years out of date and it may feel like something's off, you know, watching a movie from 1973 feels like a Twilight Zone episode where everything's shot at a Dutch angle. Something is subtly not right, but you don't know what it is. And what it really comes down to is they made movies differently back then, y'all. But when
you're looking at a foreign film from 1973.
That is true. Is it a foreign film so much? I mean, it's an American Hong Kong co-production shot in English. I'll grant it for you. I'll give it to you. But what it really does well is it says, okay, you may never have seen a kung fu movie before. You may never have seen these tropes in play. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get all the best ones, right? And I'm going to put them out and I'm going to do them in ways that are new and fascinating and entertaining. So if you've seen 100 of these wushu kind of kung fu, the guy from Mystery Science Theater 3000 refers to as the big dumb chop sake movies, which is in no way meant to be insulting, but kind of is. When you've seen these movies, this is something different. This is something more. And if you've never seen these movies, this makes you want to go and see a lot of these martial arts action flicks. And I think I watched it, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. And I've mentioned this before. I have a 13-year-old. And 13-year-olds, how best to put this delicately? 13-year-olds freaking hate everything. They hate everything. Everything is bad and dumb and cliche when you're 13 years old. This was true of us at 13. This was true of you, faithful spoilerite out there, at 13. And it's true of my widget. But when this movie came on, she's like, hey, what's this? So we sat and we watched a little bit of it. And she's like, well, this is kind of lame and 70s. But she didn't stop watching the film. And then the big sequence where Bruce Lee and Jim Kelly and Jim Saxon are fighting like 40 or 50 guys in the white gis while the other guy runs away. She's like, oh man, this is kind of dumb. But she didn't stop watching. And when we got down to the mirror sequence where Bruce Lee is slowly stalking Mr. Han, she did not say that it was dumb. She just sat and watched with her face in her hands. And I'm like, okay, this is the closest thing I'm going to get to a gushing review of this movie ever. So I feel like that alone should convince you to watch it with your 13-year-old. Or if you don't have a 13-year-old, well, don't go find a 13-year-old. Be with them, that's just creepy. But you know what I'm saying here. Go watch this. Bruce Lee. It's Bruce's last movie, so it's kind of sad. It's kind of poignant when you get to the end and you have like this big upending and you're like, and Bruce passes away like a year later. But what are you going to do?
Yeah. Except go out and watch all these incredible movies that that we've shared with you. I think any one of these is a good Friday night or a Saturday night popcorn flick. Pop a big old tub of popcorn and sit there in front of your television and watch these until your heart's content. I bet you could fill up maybe 3 weekends with all of these movies.
Stick some Milk Duds in there.
Yeah.
In your popcorn. Yeah, Milk Popcorn Duds.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Thank you, Rodrigo, and thank you, Matthew, for being part of Top 5. And listeners, here's the part of the show where you get involved. You head over to MajorSpoilers.com, and in the comments section, you share your top 5 action movies. Don't just list them. Tell us why you think that this should be on a top 5 list. I'll read them. Matthew will read them. Rodrigo will read them. And of course, everyone listening will read them because everybody loves a list. We'll talk with you next time.
This podcast is copyright 2017 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.